Thanks for flying in. We had a great conversation last night over dinner. And if we can just jump in. And the question to start us off is, why is it so hard to have a conversation about race?
So a softball to start us off.
Yes.
We had a really great conversation last night at dinner. And first of all, I just want to say thank you for the invitation. Thank you for the warm welcome to Rapid City, my first time in South Dakota. The weather isn't warm, but the people have been warm. And you know, there's a sense in which race kind of sits at the core of the American project, right? So I was talking last night about this idea that you kind of need race to make America work. And the way America works doesn't work for everybody. But you couldn't necessarily start a new country peopled by folks who've been in conflict with each other for hundreds of years on another continent without creating some new identity. And in the United States, that became being white, even though white doesn't have any sort of material reality in the world. Like, you can't go back to your ancestral land of Whitelandia because it doesn't exist, right? So it's this fiction that we've created. And in order to have white, you have to have something to define white against, right? And that has caught up African Americans, it's caught up Native Americans, it's caught up everybody who gets labeled non-white. And to talk about that in any serious way is painful. And we know that people avoid, some people avoid talking about that pain. There's a really cool paper by, the first author's name is Knowles, psychologist, talks about what he calls the three D's. And this is a kind of psychological explanation for why or how many white Americans react to this notion of white privilege that you may have heard about. The notion that just by virtue of one's identity, there are certain advantages that you get. And they're not advantages you have to work for, they're just advantages that you get as a function of the way our society works. And the three D's are deny, distance, and dismantle. Deny is about, and all of these are about a threat to the self-concept, right? So all of this is about things that are threatening. But you deny because of something that they call meritocratic threat, which is just a fancy psychological term for maybe I didn't get everything that I got due to my own effort. Maybe this isn't a fair competition. Maybe I had some unfair advantage. And that's threatening to somebody's self-concept because we have a deep-seated belief in the United States that individual effort is the only thing that contributes to life outcomes, even though we know that's not true. Distance is about another threat to the self-concept, which is I don't want to be associated with a group that has caused pain to other groups. I don't want to, that's not me. So these are the people, I call this the Stephen Colbert tactic. I don't see race. I'm colorblind. I don't belong to this group. As a way of pushing aside sort of a history that is uncomfortable for people. And the third is dismantle. And these are folks who say, yeah, this has been an unfair competition. Bad things have happened, and I want to reverse that. I want to be part of making things better. The upshot of their argument, though, is that you don't get people to dismantle by screaming white privilege at them. You get people to the dismantle phase or the dismantle strategy by saying there are multiple tributaries to the stream of a successful life. One of them involves privilege. One of them involves your individual effort. One of them involves a whole lot of luck. It's multiply determined. And if you can get people to that kind of more complex way of thinking about it, they're much more likely to look at systems that have disadvantaged others.
Thanks, Jason.
Sure.
In some of your past conversations or speaking engagements, you've set a few, you've provided a few definitions. And if we could do that this morning, I think that would be really helpful. Equality versus equity.
Equality versus equity. Some of you may have seen the cartoon that tries to explain this with the children on the boxes trying to look at the baseball game. Equality is giving every child the same box, right? Giving everybody the same thing, which sounds good. But if you've seen the cartoon, these kids are different heights. And if you give the shortest kid one box, still can't see. Tallest kid with one box is good. And then the cartoon goes on to say, equity is giving the shortest kid two boxes so he can see, and the medium-sized kid gets one box, and the tallest kid doesn't get a box because he doesn't need the box. He can see the baseball game fine. So it's essentially giving people what they need in order to have an equal opportunity at success.
Carrying from there, because we're not talking about height necessarily, social determinants of health. Can you provide us a definition on social determinants of health?
I like what the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says because it has a much pithier way of talking about it. Health happens where we live, learn, work, and play.
And who says?
The World Health Organization says something much more complicated. Essentially says that it's about the social and economic resources that are available to people that determine health outcomes. And there are a whole set of systems and structures, both political and economic, that determine the way that resources get distributed. And the access to those resources determines health outcomes like disease, disability, and ultimately death.
You are the co-creator of what's called For the Sake of All. Could you give us an overview of your work in St. Louis?
So, For the Sake of All started in 2013. We got some funding from the Missouri Foundation for Health, which is a large health philanthropy in the state of Missouri. And the we was seven African-American scholars from Washington University and St. Louis University, primarily in health-related fields, although we had one education professor. And the idea was really just, we're going to put out some policy briefs, we're going to put out a report. The report will have some recommendations, and then we'll say, go forth. And the community had a different idea. There was a real hunger for the information that we were putting out. And it was all framed around these social determinants of health. So when people think about health, they almost immediately think about health care. And what we said, and what I have said since, is health care is necessary but not sufficient to address the kinds of disparities in health outcomes that we see. So for instance, the marquee, most famous graphic, most famous finding from the report is an 18-year gap in life expectancy between two zip codes in St. Louis that are separated by less than 9 miles. So a child born in 63106, predominantly African American, low income, high unemployment rate, low median income level, a child born in that zip code, we estimate to live to be 67 years old. 10 miles, less than 10 miles to the west in 63105, predominantly white, very high income, one of the most affluent zip codes in the St. Louis region, we expect a baby to live to be 85 years old. And you don't just explain that away by the personal choices that people are making in those zip codes. Part of the explanation is the income and the education and the employment and the quality of neighborhoods and resources that people have access to. So it really was about telling that story and then having a set of recommendations that include investing in high quality early childhood, addressing economic opportunity, looking at health within schools, investing in mental health and its treatment, investing in quality neighborhoods, and working more intensively with communities to prevent and manage chronic and infectious diseases. That's it in a nutshell.
Just a few years of work.
Yeah.
Could you take one more step with that and explain simply the four steps to a public health approach to the issues that exist in St. Louis?
In public health, we think a whole lot about not just what we call downstream determinants, but also upstream determinants. So what are those factors that are causing the outcomes that we care about? I heard a really great story, and I'm not going to be able to sufficiently recreate it, but it gets at this. Some folks are having a picnic or whatever by a river, and they're noticing that babies are coming down the river who can't swim, and they're drowning. So the immediate response is, jump in the river. Let's get these babies out. We've got to solve this immediate problem. But then somebody pulls away from the group and starts running upstream. And they're like, well, where are you going? We've got to deal with this problem. Well, I need to find out where all these babies are coming from. And find a way to cut off whatever is happening before these babies end up in the stream. And then there's, you know, added to the analogy gets this notion that somebody gets the idea, well, I'm going to help the babies learn to swim, which is what we do in a lot of our kind of nonprofit and philanthropic work. And it turns out you very often need policy to cut off what's happening upstream. And you still need those more immediate interventions. So in public health, we look at what are those risk factors? What can we do to mitigate those risk factors? How do we implement what we've done? And then how do we track and evaluate what we've implemented? And then rinse and repeat. So it's much more about looking at root causes, what we call upstream determinants, to determine how we not just deal with the babies downstream, but understand what are the processes for those babies flowing down the river in the first place.
In St. Louis, maybe you can explain a little bit about the Del Mar Divide, but in St. Louis, as you've done this work, what are some of those things that are happening upstream that are causing the realities in the city?
So the Del Mar Divide was actually coined by the BBC, which came to St. Louis a few years back and did a report on a street in St. Louis, Del Mar Boulevard, which is very close to our campus at Washington University, and the stark difference in terms of both racial and economic disparities north of Del Mar and south of Del Mar. And north-south tends to be the dividing line in St. Louis. So we're situated along the Mississippi River, and St. Louis is to the west of that. High concentrations of African American population to the north, high concentrations of white population to the south. And when you look upstream, you know, one of the questions I get asked very frequently that I actually forgot about when you asked me earlier is, what surprised you in this work? Most of the health outcomes, frankly, didn't surprise me. I expected to see those disparities. What surprised me, and this is in part motivated by the policy brief that Melody Goodman and Keon Gilbert did, is the extent to which segregation is still very much with us. So segregation is not colored only signs or grainy black and white footage of folks who've long passed away. Segregation is very much still with us. And when you dig into the history of segregation in St. Louis, it becomes that kind of ultimate upstream determinant. Because when you think about all of the resources that get distributed through where you live, it's the quality of housing, it's safety, it's schools, it's access to jobs, it's transportation, it's retail, it's other services and amenities, it's green space, all of which influence health, both mental and physical health. All of it gets organized around where you reside. And in St. Louis, you know, it pains me to say, but I often say, we're innovators in segregation. And most people don't know that. Most people in St. Louis don't know that. And the rest of the country's kind of surprised because, you know, they expect it to be in the deep South. But St. Louis passes through a vote one of the first city ordinances that says we will segregate by race, we will zone by race in 1916. That got struck down by the Supreme Court. So we're gonna outsmart the Supreme Court. We're gonna start things called restrictive deed covenants in St. Louis. This is where white homeowners contractually obligate one another never to sell their homes to African Americans. They write this down and make this a contract that they've done between each other. And very often, it was the church at the corner that helped organize these, or it was the civic league or the social organization. Then you have around mid-century, after World War II, moving people out of, they called this slum clearance, moving people out of established African-American neighborhoods and now warehousing them in public housing. So Pruitt-Igoe becomes the signature development in St. Louis. Huge high-rise buildings. They didn't pay for the maintenance of them, but they warehoused African Americans in Pruitt-Igoe, moved them out of their neighborhoods, at the same time that the FHA and the VA were subsidizing white families to move to the suburbs, these newly developing, very nice communities in the suburbs. And then in St. Louis, incorporating these little municipalities. I was telling folks at dinner last night, there are 91 municipalities in St. Louis County. There are more municipalities in St. Louis County than there are countries in Europe. I looked this up. And many of them were carved out to keep other people out. Most of them not explicit about race, but using other ways. So if you've curtailed people's educational opportunities and their economic opportunities, you don't have to say race. You just say, we will only build single family dwellings on at least an acre of land. Or it will be against the law to have multifamily housing. Or you have to have shrubbery at least this height, this far away from your house, and the lighting on your house has to look a certain way. So we use these kind of zoning laws in order to effectively keep people out without needing to say race, because that's now against the law. And that is what kind of organizes the kinds of opportunities that are available to people. Until recently, we had 3 unaccredited school districts in the St. Louis region. And you can guess what the student population of those districts looked like. So it's not just, it becomes this vicious cycle where you remove investment, what's called disinvestment from certain neighborhoods, and then you look at the people who live there and you say, what's wrong with you? Why can't you keep up your community? why aren't you working hard enough? Well, you've removed all the resources. There's literally no banks, no grocery stores, no jobs, no transportation to where the jobs are. But expecting people through those magic bootstraps should just keep pulling without creating structures that can lead to success.
So are you saying, okay, so how do we fix that?
All these softballs, Matt.
Because people work really hard. And because I want my acre and my house and the park that we have down the road, the housing association or the city that we pay taxes to pays for it. Somebody built the grocery store and that's their business and they're doing it. Hardware store, et cetera, et cetera. And people did it.
They did. And nobody is discounting that. So I don't want anybody to hear me say hard work doesn't matter, individual responsibility doesn't matter, personal responsibility, individual integrity. But again, necessary but not sufficient. And that's a turn of phrase in science, that some conditions are necessary but not sufficient. And it requires a mind and a paradigm shift for the American mind to get away from this notion that only individual effort determines life outcomes. And the analogy that I shared last night at dinner is, if you're having trouble wrapping your mind around necessary and sufficient conditions, water is necessary but not sufficient for ice. Doesn't matter how wonderful and pure the water is, it will never be ice, unless what? 32 degrees Fahrenheit or lower. Water is like individual effort. It's absolutely necessary. Absolutely necessary. You don't get ice, and in this case, ice is success in life. You don't get it without water. But you also don't get it without freezing temperatures, which are the conditions that help to shape success. And we've given some of those conditions to some people in systematic ways and denied them to others in systematic ways. And that is the explanation for why we see different life outcomes. And in fact, we've gotten so caught up in this notion of individual effort that we ask children who are born in boiling cauldrons, why haven't you become ice? And we celebrate children who were born in deep freezes for how icy they are. Without questioning, why are these children in boiling cauldrons? And why are these other children in deep freezes? We've gotten so caught up in this ideology of individualism that we've forgotten, often even in our own lives, the ways in which we've been supported. And the ways in which a whole lot of luck and kind of the lottery of your birth, the luck of the draw, determined what kinds of outcomes that you have in life. So the ultimate answer is a change in policy. But that change in policy has to be preceded by a change in our mindset that says, A, we're connected to each other. We saw very starkly with Ferguson that if you leave this unattended, if you let this cauldron continue to boil, it's going to boil over at some point, and everybody's going to be impacted by that. We have the NAACP decided that the state of Missouri was so dangerous for African Americans that it's the only state in the union that has a travel ban, a travel advisory rather, from the NAACP to not come to Missouri. And that's already having economic impact. It's even impacting students choosing to come to Washington University, my university. So you can't leave these issues unattended, and it's actually in your self-interest not to leave these issues unattended. But we also have a responsibility to one another. We have obligations to one another. We should want to see all children have access to the resources that they need to be effective. We should want to see all families have access to the resources that they need to be effective. And that's going to require a change in policy, a shift in the way that resources are distributed. And yes, you in your comfortable neighborhood might have to do some things differently so that everybody can be comfortable, at least have some modicum of comfort, right? But it's a shift in mentality. It's not the way we're used to thinking in the United States.
In your report, you share a number of facts. For example, if we invested in every, if I understand this correctly, we invested and everyone was able to go to college, that the result would be equivalent to the last 20 to 30 years of medical advancements for our population's health.
Yes.
How is that possible?
Most people don't think about it this way. Education is a health intervention. And higher levels of education translate into better health behaviors, less chronic disease, longer lives. And this relationship is so consistent, there's a name for it, the socioeconomic gradient in health. And the gradient in health looks like a stair step. That's why we call it a gradient. The higher the education level, just for one example that we do in the report, the higher education level, the stair steps go down in terms of smoking prevalence. The college-educated smoke at the lowest rates. Those who haven't completed high school smoke at the highest rates. You could map that across a number of behaviors, a number of outcomes, you'd see the same thing. And so you ask why. Why should education behave in this way? There's probably multiple explanations. There's not a single explanation. People with higher education have higher income. Another one of those kind of stair step functions. Higher incomes allow you to buy the resources that are necessary to live a healthy life. Higher education also leads to having and consuming information before other people have and consume that information. So you know what the latest weight loss technique is, or you know that you should be going to get your colonoscopy at age 50. And any of you who haven't gotten your colonoscopy, go get it. But you have that kind of access to information. And then another pathway is that people who have more education just feel more confident navigating certain systems. They feel more confident advocating for themselves when they go to the doctor or to the hospital. They feel more confident advocating for themselves in educational and economic institutions. So there's a kind of intangible power, prestige, sense of access, sense of confidence that comes with having higher levels of education because it's a marker of respect in society. And of course, underlying all of this, and kind of animating all of this, is stress. The stress of having fewer resources, the stress that attends poverty, wearing and tearing on the body in very tangible ways that causes disease and ultimately premature death.
Along those lines, I think I read that people miss 4.5 days feeling hopeless with anxiety or being overwhelmed. 4.5 days, and you do this in your report, which I think is so, I think it's brilliant. You turn all your findings, it seems, into we're leaving chips on the table in our community, in our society. This costs us $4 billion because we don't do this. This costs us all these other resources because we don't. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think communities may tend to focus on issues and don't look too far downstream, and we want to insert resources to meet the need that we see right now, and darn it, we're going to fix it, versus how you've written and how you talk. And could you speak about that a little bit and where that comes from?
Well, one of the goals of the project from the outset was to say, we can't just tell the moral story here, because the moral story hasn't worked. The moral story is compelling to some audiences, to some listeners, but we've got to tell the economic story here. How is this impacting? And I wish we could have broken it down per capita or per household, because that's what would really get people's attention. This is what allowing these disparities, allowing these inequities to continue is costing me. And it's considerable cost. You ought to care that your neighbors are dying at rates, alarming rates. We've got an infant mortality rate for African Americans that is three times the infant mortality rate for whites in St. Louis. That's babies. We define infant mortality as dying before your first birthday. That's unconscionable. People ought to care about that, just from a human standpoint. But there are people for whom that is not compelling enough. So we looked at what does loss of life for adults actually costing? Premature death among adults. And that's where that $4 billion number comes from. Because these issues are too important to not be sophisticated about how we communicate about them. And there are a whole lot of people who sit further on the left of the political spectrum, and I teach a lot of them. In a school of social work. And I tell them there's an equation for progress. It's what's right plus what works. Because I am a diehard pragmatist. But we like to scream, some of us who consider ourselves more progressive, like to scream what's right at you and assume that that's going to get the job done. And it's not. It's got to be what's right plus what works. It's got to be a calculation that says, yeah, you ought to care, but this is also costing you something. So let's combine those two influences to get to motivate you to make change. Let's have sophisticated messages that are delivered to the audiences in the ways that they can hear them. Because there are certain people for whom the moral argument isn't going to carry the day. There are other people for whom they don't want to hear the economic argument. This moral argument was fine. But we have to deliver both of those messages if we're going to get to the kind of change that we want to see. It's not another issue. for instance, mass incarceration. Everybody cares about mass incarceration now. Not because all of a sudden we woke up and said, oh my God, we're imprisoning too many people. We've gone from a few hundred thousand to over 2 million people in prisons. This is actually costing states and the federal government a whole lot of money. It's not an efficient use of resources. I would contend that that's why we're having this conversation. And that's why people across the political spectrum are now saying we need to rethink criminal justice and the way that we approach that.
So the facts of St. Louis and the process that you went through, and that's all fine, and that's all St. Louis. But we live in Western South Dakota.
I noticed.
And it gets cold here, and we have, and we're 75,000 people in Rapid City, and we're 125,000 people maybe around Rapid City combined. We're a service hub. Are your findings transferable? Are the findings transferable? Yeah.
The factors and the dynamics are transferable. Our findings are specific to St. Louis, using St. Louis data. But the association between poverty and education and the quality of neighborhoods, access to resources, access to jobs, that's universal. And we're actually beginning to see Angus Deaton, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, and his wife Ann Case have put out a couple of papers now on what they're calling deaths of despair. They're noting an increase in mortality among middle-aged, rural, mostly working-class whites. And they're calling them deaths of despair because part of what's driving this increase in mortality is opioid addiction and overdose, alcoholism, and suicide. And their hypothesis is that people are dealing with such dire economic circumstances and feeling so hopeless in terms of their chance of bettering themselves and doing better for their families that they're essentially self-medicating with painkillers and alcohol and other drugs, and that this is foreshortening their lives. Many of these are the same structural economic factors that are impacting communities of color in urban areas. It's a lack of opportunity, a lack of resources, a lack of investment in human capital as a nation that we have to come to terms with. But instead of coming to terms with it, our politics has been about blaming groups of people for what are deeper structural economic realities. I wish I remembered who I heard this on NPR, and I wish I remembered who said it so I could attribute it to them. But they essentially said, every 4 years our politicians promise us that we're going to get back to the post-World War II economy in the United States. And we're not, ever. That's hard to hear. That's hard to swallow. But it's the truth. We're never going to get back to you can graduate from high school on a single income, raise a family, send them off to college, retire with your gold watch 30 years later, having worked for the same corporation. It's not coming back. And what's even scarier that we haven't dealt with is, you know, we hear this talk around immigration being this big factor in terms of where jobs are going. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's not immigrants, it's robots, in a really big way. That's where the jobs are going. It's automation, not immigration. But we spend all this time and energy immigration, it turns out, is one of the things that's keeping our economy afloat. Because the influx of new people into the United States helps us in terms of our population, whereas countries in Europe and parts of Asia are now paying young couples to have children, begging folks to procreate, because their replacement rate has gotten so low, more people are dying. People are dying at a faster rate than children are being born. Immigration actually allows our population to have some growth and stability, which is crucial for our economy. So we get sidetracked into these conversations that aren't the actual conversation we should be having. The actual conversation we should be having is, what does this automation mean for our economy, and what do we do with this workforce? What are the new jobs? How do we actually support people? How do we actually invest in human capital? How do we make sure that people have a minimum set of resources for having a livable life? It's a much different conversation, and no one, I don't care if you're a Republican or Democrat, is having that serious conversation. But that's what's actually facing us as a country. So yeah, it transfers. These are the same dynamics, and they transfer. Now, the problem is, and we talked about this at dinner last night, we don't get to just join hands and say, now we're in it together, and sing around the campfire. We have to address the legacy of hundreds of years of cumulative disadvantage for populations who've been left out. So you don't get to skip that step and say, we're all brothers and sisters, and that was unfortunate, but now we're gonna do a do-over. There was an analysis done recently that it would take 228 years for the average African-American family to accumulate the wealth of the average white family. And I think 84 years for the average Latino family, which were the only three groups that were covered in this research. So at the current rate of growth, 228 years. And what that means for folks who aren't thinking about this fully is not that you've closed the gap in 228 years. You've just gotten folks to 2017 levels in 228 years, while those other families continue to accumulate wealth and leave people in their dust. That is a structural set of realities that you have to deal with if you're truly going to level the playing field. And that's going to require some sacrifice. It's going to require us to tell a different story about who's human, who matters, and what kind of country we want to live in.
If we shift a little bit to, you're obviously a very, very bright man, you've had lots of factors in your life that have supported you. When you think of a mentor that has been in your life, is there one that stands out and why?
You know, I talked about the lottery of birth. I hit the jackpot. My parents are still my biggest cheerleaders, bathed in love, but really like remarkable human beings. So my dad is born in 1938 in Mississippi. So let that sink in. Black boy born in 1938 in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta. moves to St. Louis when he's about 8 years old, starts working immediately. So I often tell people, I don't need lectures in personal responsibility. I've got a family full of people taking personal responsibility. Becomes the first African-American advertising executive at St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And I think they, I can't verify this, but I think they were testing him in terms of the territories that they gave him to cover. Because it was West St. Louis County, or it was South St. Louis County, which do not have high African-American populations. And my father decided one day while driving around for his job, I'm going to build a house here. And here was a part of St. Louis County called Crèvecoeur, because we like to butcher the French language in St. Louis. And this was one of those suburban municipalities that I was talking to you about, but a very comfortable, relatively affluent municipality. And my mom thought he was crazy, like, what are you talking about? We're gonna move out there. He built a house there, still lives there. Sent me and my sister to private schools. Took out a second mortgage on the house so I could go to Harvard. My dad's my hero. My mom's my hero too. Put herself through graduate school with two little kids at home. Started off as a teacher, retired as a principal in St. Louis public schools for over 30 years. So those are my mentors. I mean, those are, and that's a whole lot of luck. And I look around St. Louis and I see there but by the grace of God go I on a daily basis. Because there was nothing inevitable about whatever success I've achieved in life. And I don't attribute it to my brightness or anything else like that. A whole lot of luck, a whole lot of love. And I want every child to be bathed in that kind of resource and that kind of opportunity.
What is the most important piece of advice that you've received?
It's not advice that I received from a person. There's a book by a Franciscan priest named Richard Rohr called Adam's Return. And he says that male initiation rites in traditional societies, which we've lost in contemporary society, particularly Western society, was supposed to teach you five things. Life is hard. You're gonna die. You're not in control. You're not that important. And your life is not about you. And that is so true. And our entire culture militates against those truths. We quarantine and sanitize death. We want to control everything. We've all got these supercomputers in our pockets, trying to control how many steps we take and how many texts we send and how many likes we've gotten on social media. Our lives are not about ourselves. So that's those kinds of bedrock truths are some of the best lessons that I try to continue to come back to again and again.
You talked about policy, you talked about changing. Last night you called it a paradigm shift. What's the most important characteristic of a leader that we need to do this? What are the characteristics that we need to have in leaders to do what you're talking about?
telling people the truth, even when it's hard. Expecting more of people. Not leading based on the lowest common denominator and the deepest, darkest fear, but leading based on our best hopes and what's the best in us. I think leaders call forth the best in other people and aren't leading for their own self-aggrandizement or their own egos. They're leading because they understand that the people that they're leading have vast resources. And if you could tap those resources and channel them in the right way, you could see remarkable change, not just in society, but in people's lives. That's what real leaders do. It's not the person talking the loudest, getting the most attention. It's the person who's looking for that thing inside of you, and how do I help call it forth so we can get good things done?
We have about 3 minutes.
So you're telling me to be brief.
I have about 3 questions.
I will be brief.
So this is your question. Why haven't we dealt with these issues?
In part because we've got this kind of toxic ideology around individualism. When you can't see the entire field of play, it's hard to create remedies that address that. And related to that, we haven't dealt with the ways in which particular groups of people have been harmed. And I don't just mean communities of color. I mean women, I mean people with disabilities, I mean a whole range of folks who've been systematically excluded from certain opportunities. We don't deal with that because those of us who've had advantages don't want to give them up, A. And it's painful to actually look squarely at a history and a legacy of systematically excluding and in some circumstances not just excluding but actually harming and killing groups of people. That's painful to look at, and we'd rather not deal with it.
Our next guest is Dr. Tia Roseman Clark. She was born in Yugoslavia. At the age of 15, she was directly affected by the war. And she has co-founded an organization called Green Card Voices. It's an organization dedicated to sharing the stories of immigrants with the goal of shrinking the divide between immigrants and non-immigrant communities in the United States. What would you ask her?
I would want to know how she landed on storytelling, because I think that's so crucial. I think stories are the way that we understand the world, much more than numbers and statistics will ever be. I think it's brilliant to try and bridge that divide through stories, so I would love to hear how she decided that stories were the way to go, rather than some other forms of advocacy.
Thank you.
Thank you.